Thank you, Mr. Martin. We are very happy to be back. It was a wonderful trip. It was long. And I tell you, next time we have to fly, we're going to look for the shortest possible flight and really think hard, is it worth the savings? Because we drove to Seattle, or we drove to Olympia, then rode to Seattle, then flew to Pensacola, drove to Panama City Beach, and then reversed the process. So it was a wonderful trip. We got to do some things. Fran Newman came along with us, and we all had a great time. The weather was wonderful. Nothing like parking when it's when you're working on parking when it's 100% humidity and near 90 degrees. You know, it even rained on us a couple times. But, you know, it's to get out and to meet new people. We ran into some people that we haven't seen since college 20 years ago. And we got to renew some friendships. And that's what it's all about at the feast, is to fellowship and to learn. And the messages we had were wonderful. And I know the messages here, I've been told, were wonderful as well. And it seems to be the way it is everywhere you go. Well, at the feast this year, in Panama City Beach, there was a number of references in different messages to the Great Tribulation. We focus on the world each year at the feast for a world that's coming at the end of this world. And once in a while, they'll spend some time and they'll cover different aspects of the Great Tribulation, but you generally focus on what comes after the tribulation. And from time to time, you will get sermons on trials and tribulations that each of us go through. And we know that the tribulation is coming. But, you know, when Mr. Roy Halladay was talking about the ugliness that and the hatred that exists in this world, that it exists for so many generations. And when you go through the Great Tribulation, all of these hatreds are just going to start playing off of each other. And people are just going to be, I mean, what we saw in Rwanda, I mean, those kinds of things are just going to be all over the place during the Great Tribulation. And then in the world tomorrow, that hatred's not going to just disappear. For those people that live on, they're going to have those hurt feelings, those anger issues, some of the generational things. And so, you know, just talked about how hatred and the persecution that's going to come is going to really affect all of us, whether we go through it or not. We're going to have to deal with it. Next, we heard a sermon by Mr. Andy Burnett, and he talked about the remnant of Israel that will live through the tribulation. And, you know, we talk about how modern-day Israel is going to be attacked and punished during the tribulation, and we can read through the Revelation and some of the books in the Old Testament and read some of those. And it was just very sobering to consider how few that the Bible says from Israel in modern day times will actually live through. He estimated as little as a tenth of modern day Israel will live through into the world tomorrow. And it's really gotten me thinking about the sheer numbers of all those dead. We often think about the time globally, what's going to happen. A third will die from war and a third will die from pestilence. And those are huge numbers and all that. But when you start talking about Israel and how few people there really will be, he read a definition for what the word remnant means. And he says a very small surviving group after a group is destroyed. A very small group. And he read a number of scriptures about it. Turn over to Romans 9. Romans 9. He covered a little bit about some of the words that Paul talked about in relationship to this. And Paul was talking to the Jews of his day, talking about how God has not so much given up completely on Israel, but that Israel pretty much has given up on him, and that he has gone out and you can read in verse 25 of Romans 9 where he quotes Hosea, talking about how I will call them my people who were not my people, and her beloved who was not beloved, talking about the Gentiles and bringing them into the family of God. And Paul was telling this to the Jews of the day, and you can imagine what they were thinking. They're thinking that they are the privileged ones, God's people, and that someday the Messiah is going to come back and free them from Roman oppression. They're not ready to hear that God is telling them that they're probably not going to make it. And in verse 27 of Romans 9, Paul quotes Isaiah when he says, "Isaiah also cries out concerning Israel. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, the remnant will be saved." There's that word remnant again. A very small number will be saved. So when you look over here, let's turn over to Isaiah and read what Paul was quoting. Isaiah 10, and this is the passage that Paul was quoting from. He's talking about the end time, and it says in Isaiah 10, in verse 20 through 23, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel, and such as escaped of the house of Jacob, will never again depend on him who defeated them, but will depend on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. In truth, the remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty of God." Now, first you might look at this and think, well, the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, a remnant came back. Israel, and which made up of the northern kingdom of 10 tribes and the southern kingdom of Judah, was pretty much wiped out, taken into captivity, and a small remnant did return. But what Isaiah is saying here, he says, "will never again depend on him who defeated them." Well, this certainly isn't the case, because Israel had to defend on everyone that defeated them in the future. Later, the Romans, and then scattered amongst the nations to depend on them. This is talking about a time where this remnant will never again turn from God. It's easy to see the word Israel and think of the Jews that are remnant of that once kingdom, but the Jews today are a remnant of Judah and not of all of Israel. And what it says here in verse 21, "the remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob." It say the remnant of Judah, which was one of Jacob's sons. It said the remnant of Jacob. Jacob, who was named, whose name was changed to Israel, and pretty much was the father of all the tribes of Israel. So down in verse 22 it says, "For though your people, O Israel, be as the sand of the sea, a remnant of them will return. The destruction decreed shall overflow with righteousness." Now remember the sands of the sea promise was given to Abraham, Jacob's grandfather. So Paul was reading these things to these people, trying to tell them that bad times are coming and they need to get their minds around it. And there was a purpose to hear about bad times are coming. And that's what I'd like to talk to you today about. That a lot of times we don't think about the bad times that are coming. But for all of us, you know, the bad times might be the Great Tribulation. It might be before then. We might live to see the return of Christ. We might not make it that far. We don't know. And to sit there and think to ourselves, well, those are bad things. I don't want to think about those. I want to think about happier things. Then we're missing some of the lessons that God wants us to learn from these trials and tribulations that are going to come upon the world and come upon each of us. And some of us have already gone through some of these things already. So when Paul read this, he was reading this with the understanding that he was living in the last days. In those days, they thought everything was being said was for that was the final generation. And at that time, the 10 tribes of Israel that were lost were scattered about. They had some understanding of where they were, but they certainly weren't as the sands of the sea at that time. Today, we look at modern-day descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, and we think, okay, United States, Britain, all the Commonwealth and all the different peoples that were scattered around the world, that could be like the sands of the sea. And even today, when you add up all of the descendants of all of the tribes of Israel, yeah, this definitely sounds like it's talking about a multitude of that could be described as the sands of the sea. So Paul is trying to tell the Jews of his day that the future for them was grim if they didn't change their direction and follow Jesus Christ. Let's turn over to Acts 28. Acts 28, we're going to read how they received this message. Of course, as you think about what it would have been like to hear this, here you're thinking Messiah, Savior, we are going to be saved. You don't think spiritual salvation, you think physical salvation, because you're in bondage. What do the Jews know about bondage? Well, their whole history is about bondage. You think about Moses and being saved. They weren't thinking about some spiritual salvation. They were thinking about something physically happening. So how did they receive this message where Paul pretty much said, only a remnant of you people are going to make it to see the Son of Man? So Paul tells them, and in Acts 28, starting in verse 24, and it says, and some were persuaded by the things which were spoken, and some disbelieved. So when they did not agree among themselves, they departed after Paul had said this one word. And basically, he had read a passage, and the passage went, saying, go to this people and say, here you will hear, and you shall not understand, and seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of the people have grown dull, the ears of the hearing are hard, and their eyes have been closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them. Therefore, let it be known to you that the salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles, and they will hear it. And when he had said these words, the Jews departed, and there was a great dispute among themselves. So they couldn't handle what they were hearing. They had in their mind what they thought the future was going to be. And they were pretty sure that it was going to happen a certain way. I'm sure that in different times of the year, different prophecies were read, and people said, yeah, I know what that means. That means this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen. And, you start reading about the coming Messiah and what that means for salvation. And they pretty much had it all worked out in their head. The Jews of Paul's day had heard and read prophecies of Isaiah and Ezekiel and had pondered their meaning, but they did not use that information to turn back to God. Sort of kind of in their back pocket. I'm going to be okay. That's what they used it for. God's going to take care of us. And they kind of just live their life. And you think about growing up in the church for so many years, we talked about similar issues. There's a great tribulation coming, but there's a place of safety, and God's going to look after his people. And you kind of put that in your back pocket. You think, okay, the tribulation is not something I have to worry about. But we don't know how everything's going to handle. How everything's going to play out. I mean, the Revelation talks about God's people that will suffer tribulation. It talks about some of God's people suffering in the tribulation. It also talks about people being saved. We don't know where we're going to be. We don't know what God has in store for us. And to not allow ourselves to think about what might be a dark and dreary future and think, what does that mean for me? We are selling ourselves short. And we're not giving ourselves every opportunity to grow and to turn, just like Paul was telling the Jews of his day. The Great Tribulation is going to be a horrible time on this earth. And there will be probably a tendency to say to yourself, I'm not going to think of such things because they're ugly, they're dark, they're scary. But not everyone will have to wait to go through the tribulation. Some people will suffer even today. And we read about those when we read the prayer lists that are sent out. There are people today suffering Great Tribulation, that are going through horrible things. We've had recent prayers going out for people. And people have to go through these things today. We know that a lot of us are being tried on a daily basis. And to think that, well, the Great Tribulation is not something I have to worry about. We don't know that. We don't know that the Great Tribulation is not going to be something that we are going to have to go through in our lives today, even before the Great Tribulation comes. You know, on our trip, our first day that we spent there, we went to see Battleship Park in Mobile, Alabama. And it was wonderful. adventure there. We got to crawl all over the Battleship Alabama, and you go down into the decks and just, I mean, you could spend so much time there, and we only had the afternoon. And there was a submarine there you could go on, and a whole park outside with aircraft and all sorts of things that you could go. And as we were kind of getting toward the end of our trip, I had noticed a man in the lobby of the gift shop, and he was doing some kind of a book signing, and I really wasn't paying much of attention. But he was in full military uniform, and I wanted to know what the book was. And so I walked over there and looked, and lo and behold, the book he was signing was a book called Hell's Guest, right here. And it's a book about the Bataan Death March. And he wrote the book because he was in it. And he's this gentleman right here in this picture. It was taken by the by a Japanese photographer. And his name is Glenn Frazier. And he had gone through the Bataan Death March and the aftermath afterwards. And he'd written this book. And I got a chance to talk with him a little bit. And, you know, and after reading this book and hearing his story, this man went through the Great Tribulation. You know, it wasn't the Great Tribulation, but if you look at the elements that he suffered and that those around him suffered, and you compare it to what's in Revelation, you can't find much of a difference, honestly. When he was 16 years old, he got into an argument with the parents of a girl that he was trying to woo for marriage. They were trying to get her to marry someone else, and he'd have no part of it. And so he stormed off, said he never wanted to see her again. And so he ended up in one of these, what he called a juke joint. Nobody knows what a juke joint is. I'm sure there's people here that know and would be happy to tell you all about them. So he decided to take revenge on the owner of the place who kicked him out of this juke joint for having a bad attitude. So he got out there and got on his motorcycle and decided to ride it into this place, tearing the doors off of the place and tearing up the dance floor and being chased out of there by the owner with his shotgun. He figured it was only a matter of hours before he was going to wind up in jail. And he knew that if he went to jail, his life was just going to be over. He felt that was going to be it for him. And he was looking for an escape. So he decided, he looked older. He said he looked much older than his years of 16. He went to an Army recruiting center and said, I'm 18. And they took him. Without identification, they just took him. And so he got to go anywhere in the world that he wanted to go, because this was before the war. And he says, I want to go to the Philippines. That's about as far away from this problem as I can get. It was 1941. And so he found himself over there in the Philippines just 3 months before the war started. So when the war started, he thought, wow, what did I get myself into? I would have been way better off in jail than I was here. On December 7th, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and he talked about being around the radio, listening to all their accounts, and all the men saying, boy, they got Pearl Harbor unawares. They're not going to catch us that way. In 10 hours, they caught them just as unaware. And they wiped out the Air Force garrison there in the Philippines. They wiped out the Air Force garrison at Wake Island. The Japanese pretty much just dominated every battle they had in those early days of the war. And for 4 months, they fought this bitter battle on the Philippines, on the island, or on the main island of Luzon, on the Bataan Peninsula. It seemed that everywhere the Allies were getting creamed. And after 4 months of fighting, when Glenn was wounded twice in hand-to-hand combat, it was hard to believe that things could get worse. At dawn, on April 9th, 1942, just 4 months later, and against the orders of Generals MacArthur and Wainwright, Major General Edward King, commander of Luzon Force in Bataan, the Philippines, surrendered more than 78,000 troops. 67,000 of those were Filipinos that were serving with the U.S. Army. And 12,000 were Americans. They were living on half rations for months because when they ran for the hills in Bataan, they took as much ammunition as they could, but they didn't take very much food. And they just assumed that the U.S. was going to resupply them, and they didn't. So these men were half-starving when they surrendered. I ran across a documentary on PBS that featured this man, Glenn Frazier. And in it, Glenn Frazier was on camera at one point and said, "I marched 6 days and seven nights without food or water. At the beginning of the march, a Japanese soldier took his canteen and emptied it. They wanted to make sure that nobody was going to drink." You know, when you look at the aftermath, you find that 78,000 U.S. and Filipino soldiers surrendered to 54,000 Japanese. They outnumbered their captors. But the Japanese found a way to even the numbers, and that was to march them for 6 days without food and without water. It's estimated that so many died that they can't, to this day they're arguing over how many people died. With the backdrop of the Japanese video playing of these men marching, the narrator painted the scene. The prisoners were prodded northward, 300 at a time. They were to walk from Marvelous to San Fernando, a distance of over 60 miles, then be loaded onto railroad cars for a journey to Camp O'Donnell in central Luzon. This ordeal would be remembered as the Bataan Death March. Glenn Frazier wrote in his book called Hell's Guest that he signed for me, and it was a wonderful exchange we had talking about it. He said if he had known what was coming ahead of him, there's no way he would have gone through it. He would have just found a way, like so many did, to end their lives. But you just sort of think that things are going to get better. He describes in the book on how he had some miraculous escapes during those 4 months of battle. In one section, he details about five in a row, things from where people said there's no way he should have survived that situation, to being behind enemy lines over 20 times, to at one point the truck he was driving rolled down a 300-foot ravine, and at one point the door broke off and he fell off in the ground and the truck rolled right over him and went down there and burst into flames, and he just was there without a scratch. So he kept thinking to himself, God has brought me here for a purpose, so I can't give up. I'd like to read a section from his book talking about this. This is reliving day two of the death march. He says, "By the second day, the reality of defeat had finally sunk into my mind. When I walked, it was time to take stock and think about the reality of being a prisoner of war. Never in my wildest dreams could I have imagined the events of the last few days. The unbelievable had happened. The fight was over. The Japs had won. I was in a group of men marching in columns of four down a road that I had traveled so many times with big red flags flying in the front of my truck, having priority over the use of the road. Everything and everyone had to yield as we drove the big trucks furnishing ammo to the front lines. Then I realized there was no more front lines, no more fighting for our country. Now I was fighting for my own life. The feelings I had during the last days of the fighting made me think of how true Tokyo Rose's words had been. Her words would ring like an alarm clock when you wake up. She was right. There had been no reinforcements. MacArthur was a liar. All the promises were just wishful thinking." His last comments there was in regards to the fact that during those 4 months of fighting, the leadership kept telling the men, "Hold on a little longer, help is on the way." And up until the end, they kept telling them, "Help is on the way." And even though they knew that help was not on the way, Washington said they're just not going to risk sending more down there. So the men were quite bitter. The documentary went on. It says, "No one knows precisely how many men died on the Bataan Death March, but some historians have placed the minimum death toll between 6,000 and 11,000 men, whereas other post-war Allied reports have tabulated that only 54,000 of the prisoners reached their destination. At the end of the march, Camp O'Donnell provided no relief. An unfinished Philippine army base surrounded by barbed wire, machine gun towers, with little water and little shelter from the sun, it would eventually hold nearly 60,000 miserable, desperate men. Food was nothing but lagao, a watery rice soup filled with weevils and worms. It was best to try to swallow it after dark, one man recalled, as so as not to have to look at it. Some 16,000 more Filipinos and Americans would die at Camp O'Donnell of dehydration, malnutrition, malaria, scurvy, dysentery, and hopelessness. You know, when you think about the abandonment these people have, I mean, as he was writing in here, the U.S. didn't lose that war, but for these men, they did. The war was over. They had lost. So it didn't matter to them that there was people back home still fighting. They were thinking, for me, we just lost World War II. Back in the Philippines, the worst was yet to come. Even though the defenders endured 4 months of savage fighting, a horrible death march, and starvation at the prison camps, where as many 200 men died every single day, this was the beginning of the woes. You know, when you think about the Great Tribulation, what do you got? Matthew 24 talks about there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, but the end is not yet. And then you see the unthinkable happen, called the abomination of desolation. He says when that happens, that's when the end is. These men went through that. All through the 1930s was the time when the wars and the rumors of wars, and people talked about war was on the horizon, and it was just a matter of time. And then the war came to them, and it was more brutal than they could ever imagine, and they lost quickly. Just kind of the way we think about when we read prophecy as well. And then it gets really bad. He was in a prisoner of war camp for 3.5 years, the length of the tribulation. And he calls himself a POW, but he doesn't say that he was in a prisoner of war camp. He was in slave labor camps, is what he describes his next 3.5 years. And the conditions there were about as awful as you can imagine. The treatment they endured was every bit as bad as what Revelation talks about being the great tribulation. So how did he get through it? Why didn't he give up like so many did? He talks about that at one point. Being in one of these slave labor camps, there were days where they didn't have to work, not many. But he says, at times I would find a place to lie down in the sun, look up at the skies, and wonder if God was seeing what was happening here. I knew he had walked along with me on the march. Even though I was in bad shape, I didn't get shot or beaten like many of the other marchers. He gave me the strength to resist the temptation of trying to get water, which would have resulted in being shot or bayoneted to death. When I stopped to think, the feeling would go over me that I should just give up and go ahead and die. But it didn't happen that way. Every time my thoughts drifted in that direction, I would think of home and Jamie, and I would be wondering if she came back from her visit and whether or not she'd gotten married. I also wanted to think about the other people that he knew he talks about here. And I would think I would have to go out and find for myself how these people are doing. That God has brought him through this for a purpose. He said each time a man would get close to death, he wanted to tell someone, to talk to his family or loved ones and tell them how they had died. Soon we were burying over 200 men a day in camp, plus the ones killed on the work details. I was now able to work on the burial detail, and I had 2 sets of dog tags. So knowing I might get killed outside the camp, I decided to throw a set into a mass grave there, just in case. If my death did occur, at least my body would be identified as being in that grave and would settle any question for my family. I would not just be listed as missing in action with them not knowing whether or not I had made it. There would be no problem, and it would settle things for them. And oddly enough, 3 years later, when MacArthur returned to the Philippines, they found that mass grave, they dug it up, and they found his dog tags in with thousands of others. And they notified his family that he was dead. And yet he was still in Japan at this point. He'd been moved to Japan in these slave labor camps, and he was still there. It's interesting, there was one kind of a funny note, not that there was much humor. I mean, they had times of humor in the book, outlines where the men did whatever they could to lighten their situation and to make the best of things. But after getting back to San Francisco, right after the war, he says, a couple of days later, we were told we could make one long-distance phone call and talk as long as we wanted at the government's expense. It was time for me to call home and let my family know that I was alive and well in San Francisco. I was wondering what they would say and whether they would be angry with me. So I wasn't sure how to handle myself. After all, I did leave without telling them for 3 months where I was going, as if that was a big deal at this point. Now, nearly 5 years later, I wondered how they felt and if they had held it against me for getting caught and being a POW, like Tokyo Rose had said that they would. My mother answered the phone. When I told her who it was, the phone went dead. I waited, and then my aunts answered, saying, "Who is this?" I answered using my middle name, Dowling. The phone went dead again. I waited, and soon my oldest sister answered the phone. When she asked who it was, I told her, and the phone went dead again. I was still waiting when my dad came to the phone, asking in an angry voice, "Who is this?" I said, "Dowling." He said, "I knew you were not dead," he told me. "I think I have three women on my hands, though. They look like they are dead." So he went and got a pitcher of water and poured some on each of their faces. And he told them they are still among the land of the living. You know, he went through this horrible ordeal. And he felt he had to go through this. But it wasn't until about 30 years later that he found the meaning of why he felt he had to go through this. Turn over to Luke 21:36. So what about the Great Tribulation? Why should we think about it? Isn't it the hope of God's people living at the last days that they would escape these things? Luke 21:36. When we read scriptures like Luke 21:36, we hope that we will go to a place of safety and not be around when all this is going on. It says, "Watch therefore and pray that you be counted worthy to escape all things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." That's kind of what our hope is, that we are going to bypass all that. You know, the point of Glenn's story is the same to the point in so much suffering in this current life. We don't know that we're going to make it to where that Great Tribulation starts, whether or not we're going to be in it or not, or we're going to be protected from it. But Great Tribulation could come into each of our lives at any given time. And are we ready for it? Glenn wasn't ready for it. When he got back, he had a lot of issues. He went to some therapy that the Army offered. They knew nothing about post-traumatic stress syndrome, and they thought he was crazy. Every night, he would go through these recurring nightmares of feeling like he was still in that prison camp. I mean, you can't imagine the kind of life you live for that many years. He says that one of the first nights back in a hospital where they had white sheets and beds and pillows, and he said he just stared and looked at this pitcher of water that was on a nightstand next to the bed. He couldn't imagine such luxury. And all the men were just all excited about, wow, finally. And a few minutes after lights out, the nurse on duty heard a big commotion. And when she came in, all the men were gone. A few of them were under their bunks. Most of them were outside, sleeping on the concrete, without the blankets, without the sheets, because they couldn't sleep in a bed after that many years of living on hard floors, sometimes living on bamboo huts. Imagine what laying on bamboo does to you, especially when you've... He went from 190 pounds down to about 140, 130 pounds. I mean, he was skin and bones. You know, we have many examples that turn out better than some of the grim things we think about. We listen to some of the reports about people that are suffering today, and they're not all doom and gloom. Yes, people do die, and we do pray for them, and sometimes God chooses at this time not to heal them, but there are plenty of times where God does intervene. We have history in the Bible that talks about. And when you think about the Great Tribulation, the beast power is picturing Babylon. And you go back to read when Babylon first conquered Israel and Judah, and you read about the stories of Daniel and the people that had to go through that, you get kind of an idea of what it would be like to be in the Great Tribulation. Luke 17, Verse 33 says, whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. Now, although that's a grim fact, it doesn't always have to be dark. Because there is good news. You can read in Daniel, story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that they were told that they will bow down to this king as their god, or they would be killed. And they said, then we will be killed, because we're not going to do that. And so, in a sense, they lost their life. They were willing to choose the door, death. And on the other side of the door, death, was life. Not just spiritual life, which I'm sure that they're going to be around for that. But they got their physical life preserved as well. We also have the story of David, Daniel in the lion's den, where he was told, you will not pray to any other god outside of the Babylonian system. And he did so anyway, and they threw him into the lion's den. He chose death again, and death didn't come. Life was on the other side of the door. We never know what trials and tribulations in our lives are going to bring up, what kind of ends we are going to have on the other side of the door. Romans 8:28 says, we know that all things work together for good for those who love God and those who are called according to his purpose. And in verse 31 it says, What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? These scriptures we want to keep in mind if life doesn't go according to our plan. You know, you think about people in the church. You know, when it split up. Back in those days, and we talked about this in the past, as far as what everyone believed was what was going to happen. The world was going to kind of come together in a certain way. The church was going to go into a place of safety. Everyone was going to be okay. And we were just enduring to the end. And then the church split up. And all these splinter groups came out of it. And there was people in all these different groups. And you think about adding up the numbers for all of those different groups, as well as the parent group, add them all up. And you get a number less than half of the original size. Half of those people, more than half of those people, left, didn't go anywhere. Why? What made them decide to give up? Life didn't work out the way everyone thought it was going to happen. We were all pretty much convinced that life was going to happen a certain way. There might be tribulation, but it's going to be this way. And when you sort of put it in a picture frame and say, that's what I'm expecting. If life happens outside of what you expect, your mind doesn't know what to do with it. You think, I wasn't ready for that. And you begin to doubt. You begin to doubt everything. You doubt yourself. You doubt your faith. You doubt everything. And the lesson there is that we don't know what kinds of stumbling blocks, hurdles, and trials are going to be ahead of us. All we can do is make the most of every opportunity we have. There are scriptures that we want to keep in mind if life doesn't go according to plan. Remember that it wasn't that many years ago that all of us went through these exact same things, and we don't know if it's going to happen again, if there's going to be more stumbling blocks that we say, I didn't expect this to happen. We don't know what. We have no idea what the future holds. God gives us a glimpse of the end time. And it's a foggy glimpse at best. You can read it this way, and then world events change, and you say, you know what? I kind of read it a different way now. We don't know how things are going to go as we get closer to that time. Many did not prepare for the worst, but we need to. Whether or not we're going to go through the Great Tribulation or have a Great Tribulation happen in our lives like Glenn Frazier did here. Abraham had one moment where God really knew his heart. We all know the story. If you want to turn over to Genesis 22. When you look at the life of Abraham, and you could take a whole sermon going through his life. But you know, no, they don't call him the father of the faithful for nothing. This guy had it going on. He was pretty sharp upstairs, and he was pretty obedient to God. God told him to get out of his house, out of his kindred, leave his family, his inheritance, everything, and go out because there's something out there, and you'll find out what it is. And he went. God called him perfect. He had a lot going on. God changed his name to Abraham and blessed him in all that he did. And Abraham responded and was faithful and endured. You think about what we've come through, whether you grew up in the church or you came into the church, you kind of, like Abraham, you leave that life behind and you live this new life. And you say, okay, what God wants for me now is to live this life and just endure to the end and just keep living this life. If that was true, then Abraham would not have had to go through Genesis 22. Because Abraham, as good as he was, God still didn't know exactly his heart. He wanted to know his heart. Starting in Genesis 22, it says, later on, God tested Abraham's faith and obedience. Abraham, God called. Yes, he replied, here I am. Take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac. Notice how that's written? He had another son. He had Ishmael. And I'm pretty sure if this was given up and Abraham would have gone and talked to Sarah and said, what do we do? She'll say, take the other boy. God wanted to make sure there was no question who he was talking about. Take your son, your only son, yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will point out to you. Now, there's nothing here recorded about how Abraham did what Moses later did. God, you don't want to do this. God, this is a bad idea. God, get somebody else. No, in verse 3 it says, the next morning Abraham got up early, saddled his donkey, and took two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac. He just went. You know, you look at his story. For so many years he was childless. So many years God was telling him, this is all going to work out. You're going to be this great nation. It was him that he says, your seed will be as the sand of the sea. And now he's telling him that his son, that he said was going to be this person to lead this giant multitude into the future, is going to be sacrificed. I don't know how I would have coped with that. He said he chopped wood to build a fire for a burnt offering and set out for the place where God had told him. And you think about this in the next verse, on verse 4, on the third day of the journey. Can you imagine 3 days of riding out into the desert, knowing what's ahead of you? I mean, this just plays on you. Hour after hour of the day, when conversation is trying to be made, you're trying, are you doing what a lot of us do with the Great Tribulation, just pushing it out of your mind, hoping you won't have to go through it? Was that what he was doing? Was he dealing with it? I mean, someday we'll have to ask Abraham what was going through his mind for those 3 days. On the third day of the journey, Abraham saw the place in the distance. Now, if he was thinking, maybe I won't have to go through this, he saw it in the distance, and as they're riding up slowly for hours, watching this place get closer and closer, there was no avoiding what was ahead of him. Down in verse 7, it says, Isaac said, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied. We have the wood and fire, said the boy, but where is the lamb for the sacrifice? So obviously for these 3 days where they were traveling, Isaac didn't know what was going on. God will provide a lamb, my son, Abraham answered, and they both went on together. When they arrived at the place where God told Abraham to go, he built an altar, placed the wood on it, and then he tied Isaac up and laid him on the altar over the wood. I mean, can you imagine what that would have been like? I mean, all this time you've been telling God's going to provide, and oh, by the way, I'm tying you up now and setting you up on top of this altar of wood. And Abraham took the knife and lifted it up to kill his son as a sacrifice to the Lord. And at that moment, an angel of the Lord shouted to him from heaven, saying, Abraham, Abraham. Yes, he answered, I'm listening. Lay down your knife, the angel said. Do not hurt the boy in any way, for now I know that you truly fear God. You have not withheld even your beloved son from me. You know, you think about back in Abraham's life when they went to Pharaoh, and he was afraid for his life. And so he told Pharaoh that his wife was his sister because he was afraid for his life. God wants to know where each of us put our value. And for Abraham, God figured that the highest value that Abraham had was his son. That's what he got tested with. And we have to think about ourselves, what do we love more than anything else? Because no matter how we've lived our life, how persevered, you know, we try to be and to keep on and keep doing all the things that we know we should, it comes down to this. Abraham did those two things too, and yet he still had to go through this because God wanted to know his heart. What was the most important thing to him? Each of us is being tested so that God can know our heart. He needs to see what we love above all things. We can give him that answer without going through the great tribulation. Through the trials of his life, through the trials of our life, we can make a choice. God will see us in each choice that we make in our lives. When we go through a trial and he sees the choices we make, it tells God what is most important to us. We tell him by the content of our prayers and the fervency in which we pray them. The way we live our lives, the things that we put our stock in. You know, are we living for the weekend, as one of the songs used to say? Or are we living to try to become the person that God has called us to be? You know, we have a unique opportunity in this life before the end time comes. See, everyone else in the world has pretty much just turned their back on God. You go out in this world today, and there's nobody out there in this town of Bend, except maybe a few places we might not have looked yet, because, you know, you never know where God is working with someone. But for the most part, when you look out here in this town of Bend, how many people are thinking about God today? How many people are saying, this is his day, and I need to really think about who I am and who I'm becoming? This world is pretty much given up on trying to be a nation living under God. And we have a unique opportunity because without being told this is your big test, there's nothing here telling us choose a door, left or right. You have to choose between life or death. We all worry about having to make that choice. But we don't have that door directly in front of us right now. In fact, there's nobody telling us to do anything except the Holy Spirit that lives in each of us. That's a unique opportunity. We get to make some decisions in our lives based upon our relationship with God, not because there's a door in front of us that we have to choose, left or right. And it is a unique opportunity. And it tells God a lot about us, the way we decide to live our lives in this time. Whether the trials we go through are little or they're big, it's a really precious opportunity to become the person that God has called us to be. Even though many have died since Stephen was martyred 2,000 years ago, many have been healed. Mr. Walker sent out a prayer request update yesterday about Johanna Jankowski, and I'm sure some of you have read it. For those of you who haven't read it, and whether you have or not, it still makes the point I'm trying to make. And that is that all you know, Johanna Jankowski from the Roseburg congregation had a reoccurrence of cancer this last year. What you might have known and what I just learned last night is that the cancer had spread throughout her body and she was only given a year to live. And all the times that I talked to her when we visit Roseburg, all I saw was peace. And I saw kindness. I mean, if she had fear, which I'm sure anyone in that situation would have, it didn't show on the outside. She was just such an example every time I saw her. And I know many here have prayed for her and hope for the best. And for those who haven't read the email, Ms. Walker sent out an email yesterday and said that she recently had one of the PET scans to see how the cancer was spread, and they couldn't find any cancer. It's just gone. So sometimes when we see a really bleak future for ourselves, it's not always so bleak. You know, lastly, we have the story of Glenn Frazier here. As I said, for 30 years after that war, he was just rocked by those nightmares and the hatred that he had. Every time he said he saw somebody driving an import car, he would just go into a rage because he had to work in some of the factories by those same names of those companies and build planes, bombs, and everything that he knew was going to be used to hurt his fellow countrymen. And one day, he had gone through psychiatrists. He'd lost two marriages as a result of this. The women were understanding, but they just couldn't live with a man who every night woke up screaming in fear. And he finally went to, started to attend church again. He'd grown up in a church, but he hadn't spent very much time there in the years since then. And the minister told him, well, that's easy, Glenn. All you got to do is forgive your tormentors. And he said, I could never forgive them. They never asked for forgiveness. I could never forgive them for what they've done. And so he went back and thought about this and thought about this and said, there's got to be another way. And one night, the nightmares were so bad, it just threw him to his knees. And he said he broke down at that moment, and it was like God was giving him the words to pray. And he started to pray to ask for forgiveness for the hatred that he'd had for these many years. And he said that if he was given forgiveness, he would forgive those that hurt him. And he said it wasn't a very easy process after that. It was the start. But 30 years of hatred doesn't get undone in, you know, a single prayer. And he had to relearn how to love once again. It took him a couple years, he said. Every day got better. But then the night terrors were gone. He had horrible health problems his whole life. And now that the hate was gone, his health improved. Nearing retirement, his health started getting better than it ever had been in his life. In 1990, past the age of retirement, he joined the National Guard. Earlier, when he tried to join the service again, they told him, there's something not right upstairs and you can't serve. But now, with a clean bill of health, the National Guard took him back. And over the next 18 years, he rose to the rank of full colonel. On December 1st of this year, he'll be 86. And he's still with us. And he says, when I talk to him, his life now is happy. Because love is more important than what he thought he had to hold on to live during those times. The love of God replaces just about every horrible evil in your life. And he figures that's the reason that he went through that and he lived, so that he could tell that story. He says, you're never too old to surrender yourself to God and be used by God for some purpose. Each of us are being tested now, as 1 Peter 4:17 says, for the time has come for judgment to begin in the house of God. Finally, let's turn over to Revelation 3, one of the scriptures we used to read all the time years ago. One of the scriptures we would put in our back pocket and say, we have this scripture, therefore I know nothing bad is going to happen to me. But let's read it anew, and let's really read what it's telling us here in Revelation 3, starting in verse 10. Of course, we're talking about the Church of Philadelphia, with the Revelation and the heading calls the Faithful Church. And in verse 10 it says, because you have kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world. Of course, it doesn't say from any hour of trial. It talks about if you do these things, if you are counted worthy to escape the trial which is coming to the whole world before the Son of Man comes back, you can avoid that. But it doesn't say we're going to avoid trials and tests to the sake of death in our lives. I will also keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast to what you have, that no one may take your crown. What we have isn't just this set of rules and regulations that we live by. What we have is a relationship with God that we love above all else. Satan would love to take that. That is your crown, your relationship with God. That's what he wants to take. And we have to make sure that we do not let anyone or anything in this life take that away from us. Mm-hmm.